Hello there. We're trying to keep Choral Chihuahua going, and so we draw your attention to the possibility of listening to us on Patreon for just a few quid a month. This also magically gets rid of the ads. That's Patreon with an E, patreon.com/choralchihuahua. On with the app.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, welcome back to Choral Chihuahua, and today you have three for the price of, well, none at all, really. Eamon from Sussex, Nicholas Sammy in South London, and me in York. Hello, chaps.
Evening.
Beautifully coordinated. Let's play the jingle.
It's a Morales thing.
And as penultimate chords go, that's quite a good one, isn't it? Yeah. We were going to... someone needs to say yes. I don't know, Sammy, that's going to be you. I hate going down the line. This is dreadful. It was so nice and we could be in the room. Never mind. That little jingle that we've been using on Choral Chihuahua for a few weeks is, in fact, from a new CD. And we're going to refer to that at the end. But this Lenten episode, Sammy, do the joke.
So Lent is obviously French for slow and English for fast.
You sent me that last note and I thought, I don't, last night, and I don't understand that. I don't know what he means.
I sat there thinking, I don't get it. And then I got it.
What I really enjoyed is Robert emailed saying, I didn't get this. Oh no, I did. All in the same email.
Anyway, we're going to start, in fact, not quite with Lent in this episode when we've had a little bit of familiar, but quite a lot of unfamiliar, given that you can be... niche on Choral Chihuahua. We've got. We're going to start with pre-Lent, though. Who celebrates Carnival? Not as part of the church year, but it is the period between Christmas and Lent. I just looked it up on Wikipedia, and it said it's the 4 days before Lent. But in Venice, it was much longer. It was after Christmas, right up until Lent. And Venice doubled in size, apparently. Well, not the actual town, but the number of inhabitants doubled. It was a huge thing, as it is now. And we've got a piece from 1590. It's a mask. It's a mask of the Friulians from Giovanni Croce, who was a Venetian composer. He was from Chioggia, and he became a chorister and then a lay clerk at St. Mark's Venice, and eventually the master of the choristers. He wasn't entirely approved of. When he went for the job at St. Mark's, one of the procurators, that's easy for me to say, complained about young persons who have gone about like mercenaries to sing in churches, celebrations and banquets, frequently carousing at fountains, singing canzonettas with a glass of wine in hand. Well, here's Crutch's Mask of the Friulians. And let's play that in.
Rendez-vous
Well, that's the mask of the Friulians. Friulians, I'm not having much luck today. Performed by Yves Agilien. It's 21 years old, that disc. I think neither of you gentlemen on it, but Robin Tyson, as we were just saying, Stephen Carter, James Gilchrist, Nicholas Hendelsmith, Matthew Brook, Giles Underwood, and Eligio Quintero strumming away. But you've sung in that, haven't you, Eamon?
I have a few times, actually. Very fond memories of performing that in an Easter programme at Cadogan Hall. I remember the first half, we did some of the Gesualdo responsories. And then by complete contrast, the sort of joyful chaos of these Croce masks. I do remember that just being great fun, though. And trying to make sure that I was able to burp in one of the rests at an appropriate moment or inappropriate moment.
Oh, yes, I forget. That was 2005, wasn't it? A long time ago. Well, as we were saying, Sammy, lucky you not to have done that one, but it was good fun. Look, let's go straight on to a piece by Dawn Walters, who's a Lenten piece by Dawn, who's she's currently an undergraduate, a mature student undergraduate at the University of York, but she's been a composer a long time, based in East York. It's a piece called Pro Dolorosa Eius Passione, for the sake of his sorrowful passion, have mercy on us and the whole world. And she says it's from the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. I didn't know what a chaplet was, but she says it's a Roman Catholic prayer written by a Polish nun, Faustina Kowalska. It's usually said with prayer beads and could also be used by Anglicans. She also adds, I'm not Roman Catholic, by the way. Pro Dolorosa Eos Passione by Dawn Walters, sung by the Swan Consort, Onita Datta directing, Ailsa Campbell, Luthien Brackett, Robin Datta, Sam Gilliatt, Stuart O'Hara. Good York group there. We're going to move on to Poulenc and his, well, what we call it, do we call them the Lenten motets in English?
Yeah, I think so.
But their French title is Motet pour un temps de pénitence. And that's sort of assumed that it means Lent. But actually, I remember talking to Peter McGeary about this at one of those Franz Steele Maison Verte courses in France. And he said that the motets aren't liturgically correct uses of the text, Fini Amea, Tristis Ex, Tenebrae, etc. If they were intended for Tenebrae, for example, they would have to have been corrected. He says they're not strictly Lenten texts either. So he thinks that the English title is wrong. And he says that Un temps de pénitence, because these are written very late or published very late 1938 or early 39, struck me not as referring to Lent, but to the eve of war. It seems that Poulenc was taking texts from the liturgy and using them in a broader contemporary context in a country dreading another catastrophic conflict. And certainly the last one of the set, which I just think is extraordinary, it's a tone poem, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's what you said. The descriptive qualities of all four of them, I think, are really, really striking. They're so different, each one of them. And we had a bit of back and forth, didn't we, about which of these to play. Mm. And I know you were pushing for the fourth. But I'm quite glad that I've managed to persuade you that number two is what we're going to play. Number two. Because that's my favourite. Vinia mea electa. And the text of this one is, my chosen vine, it is I who have planted you. How then have you become so bitter that you would crucify me and set Barabbas free? And these, the lush opening harmonies, I just find them to be really full of love and affection, despite the betrayal that's going to follow. Poulenc uses these block dynamics a lot of the time, which sometimes I can find a little challenging or a bit too prescriptive. But I think in this instance, they really they carry such emotional weight with them, and they pull us between these two extremes of the sweetness and the bitterness.
And you chose the piece, so I got to choose the performance. And this is the Bavarian Radio Chorus with Peter Dijkstra.
Oh,
He's so distinctive, isn't he, Poulenc? It just couldn't be by anybody else, that piece.
You only need to hear two notes, two beats worth, to know that it's him.
It's incredibly angular at times. And I'm doing some with my masters in solo voice ensemble singing at the moment, doing a Soir de Neige. And some of it is much easier just to copy once you know the tune than it is to read off the page. Double sharps. He's got his own very distinct way of trying to make the harmony look right on the page. And it is confusing at times.
I used to stand next to a guy at Windsor who used to complain about Poulenc's music. It's just written at the piano. It's just not vocal music at all. It's just piano chords. Oh.
But I don't think that's true at all. I mean, you just got to listen to that performance where they're really going for it at times. You know, he really lets you sing. But then you've got to have the facility to rein it right back. And he's not obvious all the time. So when he says amaritudinem, bitterness, he doesn't set it in a harsh, angular fashion. It's set with this sort of regret. It's a sort of baleful, regretful look, isn't it?
That's quite subtle, that, because you'd always expect a composer to be fired by particular words. And, you know, a criticism one could level at a lot of Italian madrigalists, in fact, was leveled at Italian madrigalists in the 1580s, was that they were just doing madrigalisms. And when you bring it back to something that's so personal as the way that's set there, I think it's very effective.
It's quite a nice riposte to, I've got this quote here, that when Poulenc, when he was 18, he applied to the Paris Conservatoire and was rejected. And the director wrote to him, he said, "Your music stinks. It's nothing but a load of balls. Are you trying to make a fool of me? Ah, I see you have joined the gang of Stravinsky, Satie and Co. Well then, I'll say goodbye."
Lovely. Say what you mean.
Say what you mean, but it didn't put him off, did it?
What was it they used to say about Poulenc or his music, that he was half rascal, half monk? It's such a brilliant description of the way he kind of straddles two sides of the sacred and the really quite profane, isn't it?
Yeah, that was Claude Rostand, apparently trying to draw attention to the polarity between his Catholic faith and other aspects of the character. But isn't that what gives those things the strength, to have something so personally expressive?
He straddles both of those worlds, and yet, you know, musically he stays pretty consistent throughout. You know, whether it's one of his sort of piano pieces or these Lenten motets that we're talking about, the sound world is always exactly the same.
It's true, isn't it? Even the operas, which range from kind of absurd and surreal to the incredible kind of tragedy of Carmelites. It's very much the same harmonic language, isn't it? It's completely individual and distinctive.
We're going to move from choral to something a little bit different now. Sammy, this was your idea, wasn't it? Take us. We're in Holy Week now, aren't we? Is this Good Friday? Totally different tradition.
So this is any time really in Holy Week. Comes from personal experience, really. I want to take you back to about 1993. Don't want to reveal how old I am, but I visited Spain for the first time, the south of Spain, during Holy Week. We used to do that as a school Spanish exchange. And it's amazing. Those of us who've toured to Spain in Holy Week will remember the penitentes, which look like sort of Ku Klux Klan hoods that populate the processions that the Spaniards do, especially down in the south during Holy Week. And the kind of musical element of these processions is twofold, really. There's the marcha, which is a sort of marching band with percussion and trumpets, pretty rudimentary. It's not very sophisticated music. And then there's the other thing, which is what I wanted to think about today a little bit, which is called la saeta. Etymology corner. Now, for etymologists amongst us, it comes from the Latin sagitta, which means arrow, but it's basically an a cappella, flamenco-inspired lamentation for the death of Christ on the cross, or the anguish of Mary at the foot of the cross. And it draws together, this song we're going to hear, draws together a few different traditions. The sort of, you'll hear that the vocal tradition is very much flamenco, very much rooted in the south of Spain, in the cantejondo, which is the sort of deep song of really the gypsies in the south of Spain. The text of this one, though, is by a poet called Antonio Machado, and we're back with Morales in Seville.
Yeah, well, when we were there just a few weeks ago, we found his statue, didn't we?
Indeed, yeah. And so this is a text called, that's just called La Saeta, which is a beautiful text about how the Saeta sings to Christ of the gypsies, always with blood on his hands, always trying to get down from the cross. ¿Quién me presta una escalera para quitarle los clavos a Jesús el gitano? Who will lend me a stepladder to go up and bring Jesus down from the cross? It's an amazing, well, it was an amazing experience for a sort of wide-eyed Scouse teenager back in those days to hear this completely otherworldly music sung basically from a balcony above where they carry the cross through the streets of a small Andalusian town. So it's a really extraordinary thing. It's very much part of Spanish kind of Lenten musical culture, I suppose. And like I say, just as something a little bit different for listeners today.
Y me presta una escalera de la tierra.
Wow, that's that goes back to Eamon and me talking about commitment.
Yeah, and then some. And that's actually part of the procession, is it?
So what normally happens is that they take these floats with a crucifixion scene or a scene from the foot of the cross. They carry them on the shoulders of these of the townsfolk, basically, and arrive at the church, and that someone is waiting at the church to sing that kind of thing. It's amazing sort of spectacle.
It's just extraordinary. They're like echoes of R&B and soul in there as well. Just from a vocal sense, it's the same throughout. There's no sense of a kind of change of register. The higher it goes, just the more it gets.
Yeah, there's a lot of intensity, isn't there? And as you say, intent. You can hear the flamenco influence. And one of the things about flamenco is this kind of altered state of expressive ecstasy that the performers kind of try to generate for themselves. You can hear that in that. I think one of the things to say is that the actual song, when the sort of rock band came in at the end, that's by a guy called Joan Manuel Serrat, who's the sort of national songwriter, if you like, of Catalonia. And so you've got this kind of confluence of different parts of Spain, different traditions. And this that sort of chorus that we heard towards the end, Honores tú mi cantar, no puedo cantar ni quiero. I don't want to sing, nor can I, of this Christ on the cross, but I want to sing about the Christ who walked on water. So this kind of lyrics talking about a better time, let's say. And also, interestingly, if you like that sort of thing, that sort of rising melody is the same as Erbarmadich and the same as Zerfließer from The Passions. So you're never very far away, are you?
So almost as if we might have some episodes about Bach coming up.
Oh, well, I'm glad you mentioned those, Eamon.
Yes. Yeah, that's that. Our next couple of episodes actually will take us nicely into Passion Tide. We're going to stay, we're going to go back to earlier in Lent now, Lamentations. We nearly called this episode Not the Talus Lamentations, because Eamon, you come up with a really off the wall one here. Who was Ernst Krenek?
Yes, well, so Ernst Krenek was an Austrian composer. I bought this recording back in the days when, you know, one would browse in a record store. You know, I used to spend hours, you know, in HMV on Oxford Street, just, you know, looking through recordings. And I came across this, a nice eye-catching cover of a recording by the Rias Kammerchor with Marcus Creed.
And just throw in at this point, Rias, Radio in Amerikanischer Sektor. There's a Cold War name for a choir. Radio in the American Sector, Berlin.
I didn't know that's what it was for.
Nor did I. Thank you. Very good. And conducted nowadays by our good friend Justin Doyle. Ernst Krenek, the only thing I knew about Krenek was his opera, Johnny Spielt Auf. I remember having to write an essay about it in my first year at university. And so I'd heard, you know, bits of it, and I was expecting something that would be in a similarly sort of romantic or jazz-tinged vein, but I was very, very wrong about that. Johnny was composed in 1924, and it was a huge success, but it led to Krenek being labelled a degenerate composer by the Nationalist Socialist Party, who were growing in popularity then. And when the Nazis came to power in 1933, they decreed that not a note of Krenek's music would be allowed to be played. So he was compelled to emigrate to America in 1938, and there he taught to earn a living. I think he found this very hard. He was cut off from his friends. He didn't have the support or inspiration of his fellow composers, and his future looked pretty bleak and uncertain. To support his work, he began to study the history of music, and he developed a particular interest in the music of Ockham. And that sort of began to bear fruit in these Lamentations, which he composed.
Let's just place Ockeghem. So this is second half of the 15th century. Wrote a requiem, wrote masses with extraordinary mensuration canons and games. Wrote a mass called Cuius Vis Toni, which could be in any one of the four modes, depending on how you sing it. So intense early Renaissance stuff.
Yeah, and you can really see that influence in this. He wasn't writing to a specific commission. He didn't have any assurance that they would ever be performed, or indeed that any of his music would ever be performed again in his homeland. So when I got the CD back home, I put them on, and I've got to say, I found them really challenging. and kind of put them aside for some time. But periodically, I pick the CD up off the shelf and have another listen, and they keep drawing me in. I don't often listen to more than one lesson at a time. It's maybe interesting to note that the score is presented without bar lines, much as you know, the music would have been in Ockham's time. And it's this sense of the vocal writing. It's very polyphonic in that sense, the way the lines interplay. There are occasional quotes of bits of plain chant, but it has a very medieval and Renaissance feel to it, despite the fact that it has a serial structure behind it.
You've got serial writing mixed with that polyphony, but I wouldn't say it's tonal, but there's chords and dissonance, and the way the thing sort of goes in and out of phase of dissonance and moments of consonance without there being any sort of key to hold on to is kind of dream world, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And to this day, I still don't know quite what I think about it. So I wanted to play it and share it with you guys and also to everyone else. And perhaps you could let us know your thoughts.
And this is a big piece. This is 50 minutes or so. Where are we and where are we going to hear this a little bit now?
So we are in the lecture. This is Good Friday, and it's the third lesson of Good Friday. Each of the sections starts with one of the Hebrew letters, and this is Aleph. I am the man that hath seen affliction by the nod of his wrath. He hath led me and brought me into darkness, but not into light. Surely against me he has turned. He turned his hand against me all the day.
Thank you.
Lamentatio Jeremiae Prophetae by Ernst Krenek from the set for Holy Saturday, the third lesson. That's the Rias Kammerchor conducted by Marcus Creed.
You got a date on those, Eamon?
On the recording?
No. When they were written?
Yeah, he began composing them in 1941.
Wow. After seeing what was, or knowing, reading about, I suppose, what was happening to his homeland. Not to say why he was writing them, but I would love to sing those. It would be a real challenge, but to find those consonances, because when you have something quite dissonant like that, you have to treat the tones as consonances, and it's a different style of singing altogether. And also, you know, that is entirely a sort of European choir thing, isn't it? They have 2 or 3 weeks to learn a piece like that.
Yeah.
And that's, and you know, hooray for that, because you couldn't look at a piece like, you couldn't put that together on a couple of days, could you?
Absolutely not at all. I think that's the way he constructed the 12-tone row as well, that he allowed octaves and consonances as well. It's, I think, in order to facilitate that sound world, which, as you say, you don't quite know where it is, because it doesn't feel atonal.
It's 2 years after the Poulenc. I mean, in both of them, there's some real extremes, and you're not really going to hear words when sopranos are singing that high, but he does keep the texture quite spare at times, so the text can be heard.
Yeah, it changes throughout the set. Sometimes it's in up to 9 parts, and he calls for double choir at times, the 2 SATB choirs. Sammy, you've not heard that before. What's your take on it?
Yeah, I really like it, actually. It's thorny, isn't it? It sounds, as Robert says, it sounds difficult to, it's difficult to listen to in some ways. It's not easy listening. It doesn't sound pleasant in the way that perhaps some Ockeghem might, or some earlier stuff. But you hear the text often, and the actual harmonic colours, I think, are really imaginative. Feels like it's very much a piece of its time, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's interesting how the texture changes the whole time. I'm doing Rautavaara's Missa a Cappella at the moment, which he wrote the Credo to in 1972 and the rest of it around sort of 2010. And he writes in his note to it, he died in 2016, didn't he? He writes how it's really important to change texture all the time. And I think he's writing that because his Mass is not so likely to be done as a liturgical piece, but as a concert piece. And I'm really drawn to that in choral textures, that we all like listening to things that sound nice, but actually keeping an audience's attention constantly to the text, that's a real skill.
But texturally as well, there, if you take the harmony away, it reminds me of like one of the Palestrina Song of Songs from a texture point of view. It's in that kind of sound world, that particular setting, because it's in relatively few parts, and it's relatively easy to follow what's going on.
Yeah, the little trios here, quartet there, and this constant kind of evolution of sound. It's lovely.
Yeah, very much a sort of Renaissance texture.
Mm. Hey, you said Renaissance. Right, well, let's go and listen to some Morales then. That the jingle that we had with Greg Skidmore saying, it's a Morales thing, is nicely timed, because you and I, we've got a new series, haven't we, Eamon? Although it's not our group.
We have indeed this fairly substantial project, not to understate it, to record all the Masses and Magnificats by Cristobal de Morales with De Profundis. De Profundis, an all-male choir based out of Cambridge, founded by our friend Mark Dourish. This is the first of this, what promises to be quite a long program.
Yeah, I think it's 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock, it's 10 years. 10 years. That feels how long we've been going on today. It's a 10-year project. And who knows these days, who can say whether it'll get to an end. But it's all planned out. We know who's doing which. And we're doing it together, which is rather lovely. So we've recorded the first disc, a Mass each. And I got to do the Magnificat as well. And on the first disc, this is coming out in days, I think, or March the 1st. Sammy?
Well, I was just going to ask, I've not sung a lot of Morales. I'm sort of a fan, but can you tell us a little bit about the sound world, what it's like for the performers?
Well, I would say think Gombert. Think first half of the 16th century Gombert. Morales would tell anyone that would listen that he was the Spanish Josquin, which really probably didn't endear him to anyone. He seems to have been a slightly awkward git. The music is very high quality. It's proper It's proper imitative polyphony. So it's not just, I mean, people always hold Palestrina up as the classic Renaissance polyphonist, but actually Palestrina is a later development. These earlier composers, Morales, Gombert, Crequillon, not so much Josquin, but the ones that came immediately after Josquin, they write imitative polyphony where all the lines have the same basic tune, and the enormous skill, and it is a skill, and it was an enormous achievement to have made this, this style, was that each line is equally important.
I mean, you say not so much like Josquin, but actually the mass that I conducted on this recording, the Missa Adesilio El Caballero, is very much in the Josquin vein. So quite a relatively early piece. And there's lots of two-part writing answered by another, you know, two voices. This dialogue going on between high and low, and then little combinations thereof. It feels very much like it's a doff of the cap to Josquin.
Yeah, it's Adesilio El Caballero. What a strange thing. I first came across that song when I was 21 because there was a Gombert chanson based on it. You think, what on earth is Gombert writing a chanson based on a Spanish song? Well, of course, he worked in Spain a little bit. But the Adesilio El Caballero Mass, which is four parts, is like a sort of meringue compared to the weighty six-part Sammy, what's a Spanish cake? Tiramisu, I was going to say, but that's Italian. Chocolate con churros, again, of the Missa Mille Regrets, which has been recorded before. Our friend Paul McCreesh and Gabriele Consort have recorded it. But it's interesting because the four-part chanson that's based on Mille Regrets, which is called Josquin chanson, lovely tune, and he's doubled two of the parts. You've got two alto lines or soprano lines, if you like, here sung by countertenors, and two tenor lines. So it's quite a thick texture. And we're just going to hear the Agnus Dei. But there are, in fact, two Agnus Deis to the Missa Mille Regrets because he wrote a second sort of ending to the Mass a few years later. But here's the early one. And it includes that outrageous cadence with the two passing notes that feed into the last chord that we just extended a little bit because it's that nice. Cadence alert.
Ding dong.
Absolutely.
Well, if you can't do it in a moment like that, then when can you do it?
Just fabulous. So, yeah, Cristobal Morales, he spent some of his time in Rome, but also Seville. And Mark Durish, who's not the musical director of this, but it's absolutely his baby. He's having organ with some of the masses, which seems to possibly have been Roman practice. I'm hoping I'm getting that right because he's very good on all this kind of stuff. I mean, you had organ in yours, didn't you? Was that an issue to tune with it? Because, of course, you know, you and I do all this kind of supposedly acoustically pure tuning, but of course an organ's stuck. You have to choose your intervals and they're stuck with you for the whole mass.
Yeah, it didn't seem to be a problem actually. It was quite discreet, I've got to say. The organ in the mouse that we were doing didn't find it to be an issue. I hope that is the case when I hear the recording again. It's always a worry, isn't it?
And we should credit a couple of the singers. Well, I mean, we can't credit all of them. It's sort of mixed pro group. It's got interesting mix, really. There are people there who have very high-powered jobs as academics, but are there singing bass. There seems to be quite a few ex-York, I suppose, given my connection. Guy James from the top of the Swallow 6. That's a familiar sound.
Lovely.
There. James Botcher. Jacob Ewins, who's does record producing as well. And he's, goodness, with him in the choir, I really had to have my socks pulled up about tuning because he knows where to put his thirds.
Yeah, Stuart O'Hara, who we heard in Dawn Walters' piece, who was singing as well.
Yeah, moves around. Look, we're going to finish. We've done quite well not to talk for too long on this. And we've got a final piece, which, Eamon, you know much better than I do. This is one of my students that recommended this. This is by Cecilia McDowell, who we had a whole programme about her a few episodes back. If you're interested, do go back and listen. But tell us about this piece.
Well, I just think this is one of her absolute best. This isn't The Lord is Good. I've done it twice in recent times with my chamber choir, the Thomas Tallis Society, and this is the piece that people left talking about.
So there's a programme note from Cecilia on this who says, I chose verses from the King James Bible version of the Book of Lamentations in order to bring a sense of hope and longing rather than drawing on texts filled with desolation and deep despair. In addition, I've used a Latin phrase from Hosea, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, convertere ad dominum Deum tuum, with which Tallis concludes each of his lamentations. The two soprano solos open the work with long, intertwining melismatic phrases on the word Jerusalem. The desired effect is that the two voices should sound distant, ethereal, and bring a sense of longing. These elaborate lines lie above the slow-moving passages sung by the choir. In the lighter textured middle section, the men of the choir intone the Latin phrase as if enchanting rather than enchanting, and the work slowly proceeds to an impassioned climax before making a strong affirmation with the words, "The Lord is good."
when you have two soprano solos and you really know how to use them.
The Lord is Good by Cecilia McDowell, sopranos Susanna Fairbairn and Miranda Lawrence, with Sospiri, directed by Christopher Watson, from a great CD called The Lost City, Lamentations Through the Ages on Naxos.
The sort of CD that if you took it to a record company, they just say, no, I don't know, you know, apart from Cecilia McDowell and Pablo Casals, who's Dominic Fino, John Duggan, John Mundy? I mean, I think we know who those people are, but and it finishes with a Mauersberger, Wie liegt die Stadt so wüst? Gosh, that's a great piece. Well, I mean, given what's happening in Turkey, Syria and Ukraine at the moment, that would be a very apt piece. We could have fitted that in another time. That's great singing from a basically amateur choir.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think they were mostly...
Can you say that a bit higher, Robert?
Yeah.
Yes. How's the novel coming along?
I'm amazed.
I couldn't put it in this.
No. That's just you and me and Family Guy. No one's, everyone's going to be turning off. But that's a great bit of singing. And such interesting, just Christopher Watson, the director, was a tenor with the Tallis Scholars and the London Scene for years. Now we think in Melbourne.
Trinity College Melbourne, yeah.
I saw him there back in 2019. I had a drink with him. He came to a 16 concert when I was conducting a tour out there. And lovely it was to see him after far too long.
Yeah, he's missed, actually, isn't he? Around these parts.
Right, well, that was it. We managed to get through seven pieces. No idea how long it's taken. I said it was 10 o'clock. We start at 5 in the morning. It'd be lovely to... oh, dear. If I can get rid of this cough, it'd be lovely to see you chaps in the real. But in fact, you've already recorded the next two episodes of Choral Chihuahua, which is going to be on the Bach Passions. And it's such a great episode. We split it in half, and that'll be out in 2 weeks' time. But this was our Lenten episode, recording it just before Ash Wednesday, and a happy Allegri to everyone, whether you listen to it in English or in Latin. If Hugh Keat were listening, he'd insist most of it isn't by Allegri, but there you go. Wants to spoil a good story.
Great to see you, chaps, and see you next time, everyone.
See you next time. Bye.
Just before you go, another reminder to try listening on Patreon, which costs just a few pounds per month. Or if you prefer, you can very simply make a one-off donation. You can actually do either via choralchihuahua.com. Thanks.